Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.
Of this continued support for Israel, the stakes of continuing to whitewash its crimes, Biden risks passing and paying a very high price for this, and the Democratic Party risks paying a very high price for this, because Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, progressive Americans are increasingly making clear every single day that they will not vote for Biden.
That's Sarah Lee Whitson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Sarah Lee Whitson on Gaza, international law, and the Biden presidency. Julia Conley, staff writer for Common Dreams, writes, "Along with persistent protests at public events held by President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, recent polling is continuously demonstrating that the White House's vehement support for Israel's bombardment of Gaza, despite the rising civilian death toll, is not winning them accolades among the voters whose backing they depend on in the upcoming election." Conley cites a recent poll that 50% of 2020 Biden voters believe the Israeli assault that the U.S. has helped fund is a genocide. Young Democrats in particular are highly critical of the administration's policy, thus dimming Biden's re-election hopes. Our guest today is Sarah Lee Whitson. She's executive director of DAWN, Democracy for the Arab World Now. Previously, she was executive director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa division from 2004 to 2020. I talked with Sarah Lee Whitson on February 1st. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Noam Chomsky, in his 1969 book, Peace in the Middle East, wrote, "In no other region of the world are the problems so likely to lead to devastating regional conflict and possible global war." "I have suggested," Chomsky says, "that these problems have only been aggravated by the irrationality and intolerance that has dominated discussion in the United States. It will be most unfortunate," he says, "if this state of affairs persists." Well, here we are 54 years later. Does what Chomsky warned against, U.S. irrationality and intolerance, persist? What, if anything, has changed?
Well, I would say that what Chomsky feared has come to fruition in spades, probably well beyond what he envisioned. You know, to suggest, as he does, that U.S. policy in the Middle East is irrational certainly is correct in that it doesn't make sense from an objective evaluation of America's interests versus a review of the policies. You would say that the policies are irrational because they have no rational connection to actual American interests. However, I think that since Chomsky's quote, there is a much more deliberately nefarious approach to the Middle East, where the stated interests, the rhetoric that accompanies policies, are really just after-the-fact justifications for an approach that is entirely predicated on satisfying lobbying interests, whether from the defense industry, whether from the pro-Israel lobby, and increasingly from the foreign government lobbies themselves, but also just fundamentally housed in a ideology that believes that U.S. primacy, U.S. military domination, U.S. support for abusive governments, it's a good thing. It's no longer being even covered. It's increasingly naked, such that we can have Jake Sullivan justify to the American people support for these dictatorships by very openly saying, well, it's good for Israel, it's good for stability, it's good for oil prices.
Well, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, certainly distinguished himself a week before the Hamas attack on 7 October. This is what he had to say. The Middle East is quieter today than it has been in decades. Quite an observation, given subsequent events. So how out of touch is the Biden administration with the realities on the ground?
I would say, and I've written on this extensively, deeply, embarrassingly out of touch, which is exactly what the quote that you just read from Jake Sullivan reveals. From the worldview propagated by Brett McGurk, adopted by Jake Sullivan, completely signed off on by Blinken and Biden, the route to stability in the Middle East comes from deals with dictatorships. Comes from currying favor with dictatorships, giving them security guarantees, selling them as much weapons as we want, being silent on their gross abuses and war crimes, because that will lead them to quote unquote normalize with Israel. And once that happens and they are aligned against Iran, that is the path to stability. Never mind that people, experts, analysts, from the get-go of this cockamamie Abraham Accords strategy, which started under Trump, argued is that this is false. It's based on false assumptions and a bad approach to thinking that alliances between an apartheid government and gross dictatorships is a recipe for stability. It's not, it never will. And yet again, it took the people on the ground. In Gaza, to suffer with unbelievable horrors and bombardment, to really underscore and underline just how bizarrely out of touch Jake Sullivan was.
Well, the grand scheme, as you suggest, the Trump-initiated Abraham Accords, was also designed to bring a pariah state, Saudi Arabia, into a partner state, thanks to multi-billion-dollar weapons sales to the Saudi monarchy. So Secretary of State Blinken did acknowledge that we are in a very dangerous situation right now. At the same time, he said, we remain focused on our core objectives in the region, both in terms of the conflict in Gaza and broader efforts to build truly durable peace and security. Now, given U.S. bombing attacks on multiple countries in the region, including Somalia and more recently Yemen, what is the basis that Blinken would make such an observation about durable peace and security?
If your starting point and his starting point assumes that durable peace and security can emerge from a normalization with Israel and ganging up a more sort of solidified regional ganging up on Iran, then you might be on the right path. The problem is the secretary's fundamental assumptions that the path to security in the Middle East is through these normalization agreements has been demonstrably proven to be completely false. If October 7 proved nothing else, if what we've seen happen in the past 3 months and what will continue to emerge as this conflict expands, not just to Yemen, but to Iraq and to Syria and to Jordan, where three American military forces were killed by a stealthy drone attack, over 30 Americans injured, directly related to this conflict with the Palestinians. If those are any evidence to go by, then Secretary Blinken needs to update his worldview of the Middle East and really just discard this fantastical notion that stability will come from alliances between an apartheid government and unrepresentative, unelected, unaccountable dictatorships. The reason Saudi Arabia has backed off the normalization agreement is because even they feel the pressure of what such a move would mean right now in the face of a plausibly genocidal campaign in Gaza for Saudi Arabia to make a deal to normalize with Israel. Even Mohammed bin Salman realizes that would be a step too far and it risks destabilizing his own dictatorship in the country.
In a landmark decision on January 26th, the International Court of Justice, the UN's highest judicial body based in The Hague, by an overwhelming vote, ruled that the South African accusation that Israel in its assault on Gaza is committing genocide, the international court said, is plausible. The Israeli Prime Minister, in response to the court's decision, said, I'm quoting, "Israel's commitment to international law is unwavering. The charge of genocide leveled against Israel is not only false, it's outrageous." Almost certainly the issue will move to the UN Security Council, where it is likely to be vetoed by Washington. Talk about this decision by the International Court of Justice. Your colleague, Raed Jarar, for example, said that it was a watershed moment and a huge defeat for Israel.
A couple of observations. First off, on the momentousness of this decision, on the profound significance of this decision, which found that Israel is plausibly committing genocide such that emergency orders were mandatory and necessary. First of all, to see a state, Israel, which was created in reaction to the genocide by Germany against Jews during World War II in Germany, the basis for which led to the emergence and ratification of the Genocide Convention. Obviously, there were many other genocides before then, but it took what happened to the Jews to translate it into a genocide convention that's widely supported. For that state to now be on the docket for genocide, first of all, is just shocking and appalling. But the fact that the overwhelming majority of the court supported the observation that Israel is plausibly committing a genocide, and ordered it to stop taking genocidal actions, specifically to stop killing or injuring Palestinians, which are the first items you see mentioned in the Genocide Convention, the first items mentioned in the order, is, you know, a profound validation and recognition of what people have been describing from on the ground in what's happening in Gaza, and a profound rebuke of the United States, of the United Kingdom, and certainly of Israel, first and foremost, who have vociferously denied that Israel is carrying out acts that amount to genocide, that its incitement, that its deliberate intent to kill the Palestinians in Gaza is the basis for the finding and clear to everyone else. Now, obviously, Israel has shown over the past week that it is completely ignoring this order. When you look at the number of Palestinians killed and injured, the ongoing bombardment of Gaza, the open declarations of intent to displace Palestinians into, if not Egypt, then other African states have been proposed, the vicious attacks involving perfidy, with Israeli soldiers dressing up as civilians, as doctors, to assassinate three people in a West Bank hospital, the discovery of a mass grave with over a dozen apparently Palestinians whose hands were bound and tied, discovered subsequently in a pit, all suggesting that not only is Israel ignoring the order of the court, but that it is ignoring the most basic precepts of international humanitarian law and the restrictions of the International Criminal Court. And where, of course, Israel is also on the docket. The two most important international courts in the world, the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, are both examining unbelievable atrocities by Israel. So it's tremendous pressure for them. But it's tremendous pressure for the United States and the United Kingdom in particular, because they are faced with a choice of opposing the International Court of Justice, opposing its orders, which, by the way, by any fair reading of the Genocide Convention should include and includes a restriction on aiding and abetting Israel from committing its plausibly genocidal actions. Effectively, the message and the choice the United States is making is that they will undermine, disregard, disobey, and effectively destroy the significance and importance of the International Court of Justice if it means shielding and defending and protecting Israel.
Your colleague, Raed Giroir, again says, the U.S. can't and should not continue its arms transfers to Israel now. This ICJ ruling, I'm quoting, is something that they have to think about very seriously, because the United States as a government is implicated in these war crimes, and U.S. officials are also implicated, unquote.
Absolutely. I mean, the international law, particularly the Genocide Convention, is very clear that aiding and abetting a genocidal state and genocidal actions is grounds for culpability and liability under the Genocide Convention. And frankly, it is grounds for culpability in the International Criminal Court to be aiding and abetting violations of the Rome Statute. Given Israel's continued defiance of the International Court of Justice's orders, given the clear language in the International Court of Justice that Israel must stop killing and injuring Palestinians with intent to destroy them, which the court concluded is plausibly underway, it is impossible to read continued U.S. military support for Israel as anything other than aiding and abetting the commission of genocidal acts, plausibly genocidal acts that the court has found. And whether or not the U.S. will actually be brought and dragged to the docket remains to be seen. But really, what we're observing is the extent to which the U.S. will go to undermine and destroy these two most important institutions, most important bodies of international accountability in order to shield Israel. It really, there couldn't be a greater test of the U.S.'s stated values in support of the rule of law and accountability and human rights, and its efforts to shield Israel from accountability from them. The Biden administration's characterization of the case, South African case against Israel, as meritless. It's one thing to say that before the court has rendered its decision and the provisional orders that it recently delivered. I really would like to see if the U.S. continues to take that position, because now it's not about South Africa's case. It's about disparaging a decision of the International Criminal Court itself, which obviously found the South African case very meritorious and issued provisional orders as well. Whether or not the United States believes it was meritorious or not does not relieve it of its obligation to comply with the court's orders, which include ensuring and preventing any further genocidal acts from occurring. And I think, as you were rightly pointing out, the next big test of that will be a Security Council resolution that seeks to enforce the ICJ's resolution. But if the U.S. deigns to veto that kind of a resolution, it is a deliberate attack on the ICJ. And good luck getting any other country in the world to ever again think that it must abide by the ICJ's orders. Because if the U.S. thinks it's meritless and refuses to abide by the orders, why should Putin? Why should she? Why should anybody else? It is the end of the court.
Max Blumenthal of the Gray Zone says, given the years-long siege and blockade, almost prison-like conditions Palestinians were facing, that October 7th was inevitable.
For years, I and countless other experts and commentators on the Middle East have insisted that the ongoing siege and blockade of Gaza is an unsustainable situation that, in addition to creating massive suffering of the Gazan population, is creating a lot of resentment and anger and rage as those who are effectively imprisoned in the territory of Gaza in a heinous over decade-long act of collective punishment will no doubt rattle their cages and come out strongly against this. This, of course, is not the most recent or only incident, rather, of conflict between Israel and armed groups in Gaza since the imposition of the blockade and siege, which immediately followed the only fair and free elections they had in that territory in 2006. The punishment for having a fair and free election that chose Hamas politicians to represent them was a U.S.-backed coup attempt on the ground in Gaza, which failed. And since then, there have been relentless wars and bombardments, in addition to the blockade, against the Gazan people since 2006. So, of course, October 7 and many more acts of resistance and rebellion, and sadly, yes, heinous crimes and abuses such as the targeting of civilians on October 7 by armed groups. I believe we will continue to see these things so long as the collective imprisonment, now a plausible genocide, deliberate starvation, forced displacement of the people of Gaza continues. I really want every single person who's thinking about what should be happening on the ground in Gaza, in Israel, across Palestine, to ask themselves is, what would they do if they were living in Rafah City since 2006 under a total siege and blockade? What would be the course of action they would take? How should they protect their rights and defend their rights? I want to remind folks that when Palestinians rose up to protest in what was called the Great March of Resistance against ongoing Israeli siege and blockade, going up to the border with Israel, on the fence with Israel, Israeli forces deliberately shot and killed hundreds of protesters. Israeli snipers deliberately targeted hundreds of Palestinian protesters in the spine and in the knee to handicap them for life, to punish them for daring to peacefully protest the ongoing occupation and siege. People are running out of options. And when you corner people, you're going to expect to see some very, very ugly reactions.
Arabs and few non-Arabs, like Armenians, make up about 20% of Israel's population. What's their situation like, particularly since October 7th? It's often pointed out, quite correctly, that Palestinian Israelis have representatives in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament.
Well, with respect to non-Jewish citizens of Israel, there is definitely a two-class system of citizenship where Jewish Israeli citizens have advantages and privileges that are prohibited to non-Jewish Israeli citizens, effectively creating this dual tier of citizenship. And for example, while Palestinians can vote in Israel, they are deliberately sequestered into certain parts of the country. They are denied the opportunity to live anywhere in the country that they want. They are, of course, prohibited from military service, to give one example, and they do not have the same family reunification rights as Israelis do. So a Jew from anywhere in the world can come to Israel and automatically get citizenship, whereas a Palestinian living a few miles away in the West Bank, even if she marries an Israeli citizen, can never be allowed to get citizenship, cannot be reunited with her family. In fact, the Israeli citizen spouse, obviously typically an Arab, would have to move elsewhere to live with their spouse. So there's a variety of ways where we see legally mandated discrimination, but as well as policies and practices of discrimination that the government either promotes or doesn't prohibit.
Seeds of hatred and desire are being sown in Gaza, in the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. As the poet W.H. Auden wrote, "I and the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return."
I mean, I have no doubt Auden's quote is true. I would imagine that certainly the goal of any state should be to abide by the human rights of the people under their control, under their sovereignty, and that failing to do that will be the first source of disorder, disharmony, chaos, and resistance. I really don't like to think of issues in terms of evil and good, which tend to be subjective, or open to various interpretations. I much more like to focus on the concrete black letter obligations that every state has to respect the human rights of the people, it rules over. That is the test, for whether a government is succeeding or failing. That is the test of whether a government should be held accountable. But certainly, a government that is not held accountable for the abuses of the rights of the people under its control will inevitably, relentlessly, ceaselessly face resistance, counter-resistance. If you can't provide accountability by legal means, people will seek other means to demand accountability. And the reason we want governments to abide by the law and legal means is because we don't want people resorting to violence to resolve their disputes, to seek justice for their grievances.
You're listening to Sarah Lee Whitson on Gaza, international law, and the Biden presidency. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. What are your views on Hamas?
The most obvious observation from a human rights perspective is, in no uncertain terms for people who may be uncertain about it, I will be very certain, that the attack on October 7, in particular the attack on civilians and the large number of civilian casualties in Hamas's attack, was and is not just a gross abuse of human rights, but a war crime in every sort of clear and obvious sense of that word. And mind you, the ICC's ongoing investigation and prosecution of the situation in Palestine will include a review not only of Israeli crimes, but also of Hamas's crimes. Most recently, I think Hamas announced that it would cooperate with the International Criminal Court, including with respect to the October 7 assault, if Israel stops bombarding Gaza and a ceasefire is implemented. From a political perspective, I would say that the Hamas October 7 attack was and has been so far a major game changer, a major disruptor of what seemed before October 7, an unstoppable, unresistible ganging up against the Palestinian people and against the Palestinian rights, primarily represented by the efforts of the United States to expand the Abraham Accords, to basically expand apartheid Israel's legitimation by major Arab states, with the main prize, of course, being Saudi Arabia. And basically, before October 7, it was proof of concept of what the Israelis have been saying, and even some members of the Biden administration have been saying, that